broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
And a very good Friday morning to everyone here in the studio and to our listeners.
We're back.
Good morning.
We are morning, back. Steph. It's raining, it's cold, we're in the dead of winter. How are you guys going?
We're indoors. We're okay.
And the Pies are losing. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, but all that can come to an end tonight.
Dry July so far.
Just
12 days in?
No. It's been dry for Collingwood. Are you kidding me? I've been hitting that harder than ever.
Thinking, I was with you last week. That didn't seem right.
That was afterwards.
Yeah. Is that why Collingwood's not playing well?
Yeah.
All their players have to stay dry.
Yeah.
Come on.
Maybe.
Know what picks up your players' forms. Come on, the old Danes.
Just
got to
have a wet
philosophy.
September.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That won't be hard for him, I'm sure. Now, Louis, let's tell us about your camping trip last week.
It was a wonderful camping experience. I learned a lot, and I would not like to repeat the same experience again.
What happened?
It was a fair bit more stressful than I wanted it to be. I had a wonderful time with my daughter, but being the first time camping just me and her, and when I've been camping with other people, obviously other people have all the gear and, you know, we share the preparation
share the
of meals.
Yeah.
There's other kids around to play with, which means there's also other parents around to supervise from time to time. It's that whole communal shared aspect to it.
Yeah.
But I was a bit short on the gear and I was a bit short on the preparation.
And then a bit short on the patience.
I needed a lot of patience. Oh, my goodness. Yes. But even just from the start, it started to go wrong. When I was packing and I knew I was, my intention was to cook dinner on the fire. But if I couldn't start a fire for whatever reason, I needed a backup. So I had a little butane gas cooker.
Yep.
As I was packing, tested it out. It just wouldn't light. It just wouldn't work.
Should have known from there.
So, okay, well, that's not good. But, you know, let's give it a go and let's go without a backup plan.
Ooh.
No
safety net.
Okay. Dinner's only going to be sausages with baked beans. So worst case scenario, we eat the cold baked beans with nothing else. Mm. And we've got bread and peanut butter. We're not going to starve.
Yeah.
So anyway, get to the campsite that I'd planned. And it was closed for winter.
Oh, God.
So the plan is just getting worse and worse. So, and then, yeah, it went on for the evening and the next day. Just
a grind.
Just a grind, yeah. Was not the relaxing, stress-free experience I was hoping for.
Well, I think you're pretty damn good to keep going with it because I would have screeched into a motel and said, that's it.
Mm.
I turned on that heater, cranked it up.
Close. Yeah, and a restaurant or the pub.
Yeah.
So I admire you for
pretty
for
close to happening.
But keep going.
Yeah. Exactly. But it was a great learning experience and I look forward to going the next time.
It's like Survivor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can't kill me.
All right, guys, we're going to head into our first topic for today. And Joel, you're going to kick off with talking about the Fed Reserve and how they've cut interest rates. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, this is a bit of a trend that's happening around the globe at the moment. Mm. We've had, obviously, the Reserve Bank the last 2 months have cut interest rates from 1.5% down to 1%.
Great for my mortgage.
It is good for the mortgage. Now we have the biggest engine of growth over the past 10 or 12 years being the US economy that for the first time since pretty much the global financial crisis have now entered into a rate cutting cycle. So what does that mean? Why are they doing it? Well, obviously they're a little bit concerned around some of the cross currents, the headwinds that are being faced from Trump and China and the trade slowdown that is taking place off the back of that. There's obviously some concerns about Europe and Europe's malaise. Europe doesn't seem to be really getting out of its own way at the moment. It's not in a recession, but it's not really in a recovery either. It's just sort of, you know, meandering along. Brexit issues are playing out a little bit as well. So there's concerns that the Fed sees that while the US economy is still growing and it still seems to be in reasonable shape, they feel it just needs a little bit more of a cushion and a bit of a buffer and support in the short term, just to buffer against these cross currents or headwinds, so to speak. But it's interesting. I think that this is exactly what Donald Trump was hoping for, because it now gives him a lot more ability to be able to put a lot more pressure on China. Because one of the things that China have done since this trade war had started was that with the tariffs being implemented, they have actively pursued a policy of trying to lower the renminbi against the US dollar, or Chinese yuan, whatever you want to call it. And that is, in some respects, offset some of the tariffs that the US has imposed on their goods. Oh. But with the US now engaging in interest rate cuts, that tends to have a decreasing pressure on the US dollar, which would then offset the cuts that the Chinese have engaged in. And so this is, in some ways, plays in nicely to why into Trump's plan of their trade dispute, and supports his position and gives him a little bit more ammunition to continue the fight. So I'm not so sure that we're going to see an immediate resolution to the trade war that's going on between China and the US at this point in time. Now, especially now that Trump would be buoyed by the fact that the Fed is now on his side and now supporting his position, or at least softening any blow that these this trade war is having on the US economy.
Mm. Trump's in for a big November.
He is in for a big November next year. Yeah.
Is it next year?
Next year, yeah. So the election's next year. Yeah, so they've still got another 15, 16 months before the election fires up. But we know that all of the antics have already started. Mm. The Democrats are already in their nomination period. And then obviously the election campaign pretty much goes for about 12 months over there.
The dispute between the two countries, it's actually more often resolved. Any dispute between two countries is more often resolved by one country running out of their own domestic capital. Mm. It's the demands of their own country for the leader to back down, rather than one leader pushing the other leader to back down. If you've got two countries at loggerheads, one's not going to cause the other to back down. It's pretty unlikely.
Yeah, and in this particular case, though, Trump was always concerned, and there was always the risk that, obviously, President Xi, he's essentially president for life at the moment in China, and he can essentially do whatever he wants and has a lot longer staying power, whereas obviously the US and Trump are more tied into the political cycle and the election cycle. So that was always a risk that, that Xi perhaps had a little bit more staying power than what Trump did, but now that seems to be, you know, aligning a little bit better for Trump to be able to continue this fight a little bit longer. So,
didn't you break down sort of the trade war that they're actually having and tell me a little bit more about what that means?
Yeah, so a lot of it is around concerns around theft, intellectual property theft.
Right.
So obviously the US is a major leader in technology, innovation. And one of the main concerns that the US has had for a long time is that in order for any American business or any foreign business to do business in China, you generally had to do some form of joint venture partnership with a Chinese firm over there, and then there was this almost enforced transfer of intellectual property to that joint venture partner. So you couldn't do business as an Australian company going into China if you had some sort of, you know, great patent or, you know, whatever it might have been that protected your competitive advantage.
You just have to hand it all over.
And that was one of the major issues. But also there's copyright issues. There's a whole range of different issues that weren't so overt as well. There's obviously concerns around spying. And there's also the concern that the US has with the trade imbalances, that the US is consuming a lot of China's goods and Chinese aren't consuming enough of the US's goods. And so, you know, there's a lot of political factors that are going into this, but there's also a lot of, you know, real commercial concerns that the US is fighting for. I think that let's be honest, I mean, the US is not certainly, you know, the holy grail of trade and standards of trade. I mean, let's be honest, you know, the US has certainly had their moments of that they'd rather forget.
For sure.
But, you know, at this point in time, I think the Chinese have certainly been out there flaunting the World Trade Organization laws for a long, long period of time, and no one's been prepared to sort of bring that to a head until Trump's come into power. Mm-hmm. Now, just a quick thing, just a quick note, just a little bit further. So the US has obviously lowered interest rates. They've lowered them from, I think it was 2.5% down to 2.25% just the other day. Now, this is according to a note from Nordea Markets, so they create a Fed sentiment survey. And what they do is they assess the language that the Fed is using in their statements around monetary policy. And those statements right now are the dovish or the most bearish that they've been on the US economy since 2009. So now, what does that generally mean? It actually is actually a good thing for stock markets. When the Fed is this concerned about the US economy and how it's tracking, and they're getting to the point where they're cutting rates, this has actually been generally a very good sign for US stocks. So the S&P 500's annualized return when Nordea's sentiment score, which was as of this week below negative 0.3, the market has generally generated an average annualized compound return over the next 12 months of 13.9%. And when it is above positive 3, those returns generally fall to about 1.3% per annum. So the US stock market actually outperforms in an environment where the Fed is as bearish and dovish as what it is today. So interesting point to note. Now, we also dovetail that into what's happened with interest rates here in Australia, and we've had 50 basis points worth of cuts, and a lot of people have been making a lot of noise around why the banks aren't passing on the full amount. So just a couple of statistics here. Mm-hmm. So the Reserve Bank of Australia in the last 2 months has cut interest rates by 50 basis points, so from 1.5% down to 1%. But all of the major banks have not passed on. There's not been one major bank that's passed on the full 50 basis points. So ANZ have passed on 43 of the 50. CBA have passed on 44, NAB 44, and Westpac only 40. Now, there's been a lot of political hoo-ha. Scott Morrison, I think, has come out and jumped on the banks, and many others have jumped on the banks for not passing on the full 50%. But I think there's a little bit of lack of understanding here that perhaps has been forgotten or has been overlooked or isn't being explained. And the reality is that the Reserve Bank, when it cuts interest rates today, it no longer has the same amount of influence on the bank's funding costs as what it did 20 years ago. And a lot of the changes that have taken place with the way that banks fund themselves is as a result of what happened during the global financial crisis when liquidity dried up. So what happens these days is the banks not only source a lot of their funding from overseas, but they also source a lot of funding from depositors. Mm. They also fund a lot of their funding from bank bill swap rates and longer-term maturity financing instruments that they deploy, which means that the overnight cash rate, where banks used to lend money to one another and exchange money to the Reserve Bank and get money back, that now has much less of an influence on the actual cost of funds for banks. And so as a result, the banks are now in this situation where even though a 50% interest rate cut is being pushed through by the Reserve Bank, that doesn't mean that the bank's funding cost themselves is falling by 50%. And as such, in order to maintain profitability and even maintain their obligations with regulatory requirements around capital stability and capital adequacy ratios, you're not going to probably see the banks ever be able to be lock and step again with the Reserve Bank and its moves.
No, never again. It's an old statistic, but the statistic I heard is that the funding from the Reserve Bank to the retail banks is only about one quarter to a third of their total funding. Mm. So roughly a third comes from the Reserve Bank to the retail banks. Roughly one third comes from depositors, so people in Australia who open up savings accounts, and one third comes from mostly overseas, but from the bond markets, which is a little bit in Australia, but principally overseas.
Mm. Yep, that's right. So it's a new paradigm shift. All of these changes, though, that have taken place, I think, have been designed by policymakers to make the banks much stronger, because what happened during the GFC was that a lot of banks were funded by the overnight cash rate and the overnight money markets. And when we got into a financial stress situation, that funding source dried up quickly and put a lot of pressure on financial institutions and actually sort of exacerbated the downturn that took place when the financial crisis got underway. So, you know, taking the lessons from that has now meant that the Reserve Bank is no longer as influential on bank funding costs as what they may have been. Still important, but not as important as what it would have been.
Yeah.
Good insight. All right, we're going to just quickly throw to a break and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, and welcome back, guys. We're now going to throw to the next topic for that day, and we're going to speak to Brett, and you're going to talk about homes that have actually sold at a loss. Tell us more about that. Can I get one?
Well, depending on what you're looking for, that may or may not be a good thing. Reason I wanted to talk about this, so a report just came out recently saying that the percentage of Australian homes that have resold at a loss in the March quarter is the highest for 6 years.
Wow.
Right. So, well, 12.1% of recent sales, or for the March quarter anyway, were traded at a loss from their original purchase price. So that's quite a number. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that that the market's bad. It just means people have probably sold, bought and sold at a time that wasn't conducive to making money. So they've just made bad decisions, in my opinion.
Yeah.
To put the figures in perspective, the total amount of those losses across the country was $486 million. Quite a big number.
Okay.
But compare that with the 88% that sold at a profit. That profit amount in total was $14.3 billion. So,
right.
Okay. Yeah.
Jeez.
The thing I wanted to make a point of with this, though, because if you hear the headline, the headline I saw for this report was that Australian homes resold at a loss is the highest since 2013. You think, oh, geez, there's problems, there's all these negative things. But what it really means is that there's a number of people that have bought a home sometime in the last 5 or 10 years, we assume. Could have been longer, but more than likely only recently. And for whatever reason, they haven't been able to hold it, or their circumstances have changed, and they've had to sell probably in the last year or so when the market's taken a downturn.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at the statistics about the overall Australian market, it's dropped approximately 10% over the last 12 months across the board. That's the average. So if you'd bought 8 months ago and had to sell in the last couple of months, well, more than likely you have realised a loss. Now, it doesn't mean it's a significant loss, but by the time you add your stamp duty and other costs, you've probably, you know, your loss is greater than just the figure that this report's showing. And the reason that I think this is important for people to really understand is that we've always said if you're buying property for investment purposes, it's a long-term hold. Transaction costs are way too expensive to buy and sell quickly and to trade. And if you look at what the historical performance of Australian residential property has been, if you're holding for a period of 10 years or longer, the odds are basically 99% in your favour that you're going to make a profit. Okay, probably even towards 100% unless you've really bought terribly, as in you've paid well above the odds at the time. And to support this, I've even dug up a report showing what the median house prices have done across the country over an extended period of time. So the report I've got talks about over 25 years from 93 to 2018. So if you look at that across the nation, the average annual percentage change is 6.8% in terms of growth per year.
Right.
That's all dwellings across the whole country. So if you'd bought just any random property, assuming it was, you know, sticking to the averages, somewhere in 1993, and you had to sell it in 2018, you would have made a significant profit around that 6 to 7% per annum. Okay, so the types of dollar amounts we're talking here, let me see, average annual dollar change is around $18,000 to $19,000 per year.
Well, that's good.
Huh. So if you'd had it for 25 years, yep, times that amount, you know, you've made $500,000 or more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay?
So even though the report I referenced, first of all, says that, you know, it's a record amount of houses selling at a loss or a highest for a given amount of time, you know, that doesn't mean that property's going bad or that, you know, it's not a worthwhile asset to invest in. It just really reinforces that you've got to buy appropriately, you've got to go in with the right understanding of what you're trying to achieve, and you've got to hold it for the long term.
Mm.
You know, all of the data is basically supporting our long-term strategy and our basic philosophy on why invest in residential property and how to go about it.
Mm.
So not a negative, but just something to be aware of.
Yeah, yeah. On that, Brett, it makes me think of what you've said before about the quality of properties that have been selling lately. And in this declining market, there hasn't been a lot of quality investment properties available. Mm. Yes, there have been properties available that have been cheaper than before, but it's of the lower quality.
Mm.
Yeah.
So if the statistics of the sales and the amount of money that's been lost, well, in the boom times, all prices rise. And that's for the share markets and the property markets. When people are really getting fanatical and overconfident about a market, the consumer tends to buy anything. So even the low quality properties rose in value. But now that we've had this decline, it's only the lower quality properties that are selling. So, of course, it's more likely there's going to be a decline in value,
yeah,
because it's not a quality asset.
But do you think this is going to spook people not to want to sell at the moment? Because, I mean, these headlines would scare people. Thinking, I'm going to make a loss. I've just put all my life savings into this.
Well, let me ask you guys a question. Before I raised this topic and told you that stat and that headline, had you heard that?
No, I hadn't.
Whilst, you know, this article is probably referenced in mainstream media, so the report comes, so CoreLogic is still the biggest researcher of property in Australia, and they release their pain and gain report every quarter.
Okay.
And this comes from there. Now, obviously, other news sites take that, pick the eyes out of it and say, what's the most dramatic headline we can do and push that out?
That's right.
So it depends what media the majority are looking at. Now, I don't imagine that this is going to run into, you know, it's not going to be on the Today Show of a morning.
Not and on
the,
60 the Minutes. Channels.
No, I don't think so. It's more just for people that are regularly looking at the property market that you would see this, because if you're a subscriber to CoreLogic or you're looking at other real estate sites that reference it, you'd be aware of it. Okay, but if you're looking at it from that perspective, you're probably looking down beneath the data like we've just said here today. So I don't see this particular headline as something that's going to spook a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's a snapshot of across Australia?
That's across Australia, right. Yeah. Okay. So just to really sum up what it means that of the transactions that happened in the first quarter, so from January through to March, 12.1% of those transactions were the sales prices were lower than what the people had originally bought for.
Mm.
Now, that could be $100, it could be $1 million, we don't know, but it's just saying that's the, you know, the total amount of the transactions, okay? The reasons why, I think, you know, probably because people have either bought wrong, they haven't judged their circumstances appropriately, not really sure. But even the volume of losses is only $486 million. I'm not saying only because it's a small amount, but when you compare that with $14.3 billion of profit for the same amount, you know, for the 88% of transactions, I haven't got the calculations in front of me, but if you did that on a per transaction basis, like you said, okay, the 12.1% equals 486, the 88% equals 14.3 billion. I'm pretty sure the average across the 14.3 billion is significantly higher.
Yeah.
So property is still making a profit.
Data in there on the actual states, or is it just toll listed?
I've got some data on states. So to break it down a little bit further, and I've really only got the big three states. So let's have a look. Okay, just quickly, of the capital, so of that total amount, the 486 million that we said was a realized loss, 378 million for that was in the capital cities. Let's see what it says. So for Sydney, resale of properties made with a profit, so 3.4 billion were profitable in Sydney, 116.5 million was the loss amount.
Right.
Okay. Go down to Victoria. So Melbourne sales in the March quarter, 3.36 billion of properties with a profit amount for that, and that's against 44.8 million of losses. Let's see, Melbourne generated 23.5% of total resale profits by the quarter. sales made at a loss in Melbourne were only 7.6%. So what we're saying nationally, it was 12.1%. For Melbourne's result for the quarter was 7.6%. So Sydney was 24.3%. So that was where the weighting probably raised. If you think Melbourne's below that 12.1, Sydney's above it, I'd say the weighting and the volume of Sydney's probably the one that's pushed this up the most. Yeah. And everyone that's been following any of the data would know that Sydney's house prices have dropped more than anywhere else in the country. So it makes sense that that's the way it works. And the last one was Brisbane. What does it say for Brisbane? 9.1% of the total transactions were sold at a loss.
Interesting stats.
Steph, I definitely think, coming back to your early question, I definitely think people do get spooked and put off selling when prices decline.
Yeah.
They might not have read this report, but there's definitely some psychology of investors where people don't want to sell their loss-making investments because there's this human desire to wait for a recovery in prices before you sell.
Well, I've got friends that sit there and read the paper every weekend to check the auction results or have a look at the housing.
Right.
And I mean, they do get freaked out by what's going on. So
yeah, that's right.
And one of the issues this brings up, Louis, which I maybe use as where you were heading, is that quite often, you know, no one wants to realise a loss.
Of course not.
But the thing that can really hurt you more is the opportunity cost by not acting on it.
Mm.
You know, if you bought a property for, say, $400,000, the market that you've got's not moving or isn't likely to move in the near future, and you know you're going to realize a loss, maybe $10,000 or $20,000 if you sold today, and you think, well, I don't want to do that, so I'll hold. But what you could do is, if you sell, realize that loss, whatever capital you recover from that transaction could be put into a profit-making property or one that is growing, and over the next 5 to 10 years your financial position could be significantly better, but you've got to make the decision to realize the loss to be able to, you know, actually achieve that.
But how do you make that decision? How do you sum it up?
Well, you need to speak to quality people that know how to analyze it and have a look at it.
Yeah.
You know, so the type of people that are in this position usually have bought a property without fully understanding what they're doing.
Yeah, okay.
Or they've been sold it by a spruiker, as we've mentioned before. Mm-hmm. So the best thing they can do, if they've got an underperforming property or a property that they're not sure whether they should transact or not, speak to someone. Come and see us.
Yeah.
You know, we'll be able to do an analysis. We'll be able to make sure it's in line with all of the rest of your financial position and make sure you're making a sound decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you got to get that expert opinion. Otherwise, you don't know what you're basing your decisions on. And what we know from investing in property markets and share markets is that you can go about all the research that you can, but an investment can still turn out to be a dud.
Yeah.
Once you're in it, it might just not work out for factors that were either unseen or new factors that were beyond anyone's control. But one of the philosophies needs to be, if there has been a small mistake, you got to stop it from becoming a big mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
nip it in the bud.
Yeah, nip it in the bud. Take action early and be willing to say, okay, there was a misstep. Don't be afraid of saying there has been a misstep. So don't fall for the common psychology, which is to wait for a recovery so that you can make your money back. Because that psychology comes from, well, if I can sell out for what I bought at, then I kind of didn't make a mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's the wrong way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Acknowledge it and say, okay, this one hasn't worked. Let's cut it off. Let's get into something else where we've got some really solid information that this one will work.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, great advice. Everyone get on the phones and contact Brett ASAP.
I'll be waiting.
We're going to throw to another quick break and we'll be back after this short message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Now, welcome back, guys. We're going to throw over to Louis now, who's going to talk about his next debt series, and that is Debt is Your Friend Part 2.
Thank you, Steph. Yes. Last week I spoke about why debt is your friend and one particular way that you can still keep your debt and put your money to work in ways that are more effective in paying down debts. Now, just coming back to my reason for doing this is that the historical advice that people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s have been given by the generation before them is that the best thing to do when you have a home loan is to pay it down as quickly as possible with as much money as possible. And only once you've paid off your home loan should you be looking at other ways to invest. Mm-hmm. Now, has everyone seen the graph of a 30-year home loan where it starts high and then it doesn't really move in the first few years, but then it starts to come down, and then in the end years, the slope is very quickly coming down?
This is the loan amortization schedule.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So that nice graph, it's usually green for some reason, of the loan starting at, say, $500,000. After 10 years, maybe it's only down to $420,000. After 20 years, it's down to $300,000, but then it really accelerates in the last 10 years. Now, here's what I would add to that. I would add to that your asset position. Okay? Yeah. So if you've got an investment asset position, it starts at zero, and every year that you put more into it, it increases.
Yes.
But it increases at an accelerating rate. So this is the typical retirement projection that a financial planner will put in front of you. So it starts small, but as it gets bigger, it accelerates up and up and up. And if it goes on for long enough, you've just got this escalating line, which you can't even believe.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that by the time it gets to retirement, if you've been investing for 20 or 30 years, you've got such a large amount of money, that pool of money earning a modest amount of return is what produces your retirement income.
Yeah. Mm.
And so that's what how you end up with $1 million for retirement or $2 million for retirement or whatever the number is that produces this massive amount of income for your retirement.
Mm.
Now, here's the thing. If you have a 30-year mortgage that you then pay down and only then you start your saving for into assets, so you if your asset accumulation starts from zero when you're around age 60, and let's say you only give it 5 years, it's not a lot of time to accumulate assets. Mm-hmm. Even if you pay off your mortgage early, let's say you pay it off by age 55, or and for your average person in today's world, you're getting your first loan, your first home with your first mortgage at age 30, 35. You're getting your second and bigger home loan around age 45.
Yep.
So to pay off a mortgage by age 55, well, there's not a lot of people doing that.
No.
But even if you could, only giving it 10 years to accumulate assets, it's not enough time for those compound returns to kick in.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to say is that you need to start accumulating assets sooner. You can't wait for your mortgage to be fully paid off before you start putting more money into accumulating assets.
Mm.
You got to get that journey started sooner so you can get the compound returns for longer. And what I've got today is a few projections and comparisons as to why it's better to put money into investments rather than into paying down your home loan.
And this is in the context of a low interest rate environment that we're looking at today.
Exactly. Because the advice from generations before comes from when interest rates were 10% or 15% on your home loan. Whereas today, interest rates are now 3.5% for a new home loan at the moment.
Yeah.
But house prices are higher.
Well, yes, they're higher. But what I'm looking at is if you have an extra amount of money, should you put that extra money into reducing your home loan debt or should you put it into an investment?
Mm. Yeah.
So yes, home loan amounts are higher, but what I'm looking at is for people that have their savings in place and have that choice of, I've got this extra money that I've saved, it's going to go into my long-term wealth creation future, where should I put it?
Mm.
Decision one is to put it in my home loan, and I'm a financial planner, so I'm conservative, so let's say it's a 4% interest rate. If you've got $1,000 a month of savings, which is a good amount of surplus, $1,000 a month of savings, let's put that $1,000 per month into extra mortgage repayments.
Mm-hmm.
So every $1,000, you're effectively earning, let's say 4%, because you are reducing the amount of interest that you pay by 4% mm. after tax.
Yeah.
So after, let's say 15 years, let's take that as our time frame. You have put $180,000 of savings into your mortgage, and you've reduced your mortgage by $240,000.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So your total better off amount is $240,000.
Yep.
Of which $180,000 is the pure money that you put into right. it.
So in effect, your investment return is at $60,000 if you use
that's
that
right.
as analysis.
Yeah. So yep. you've reduced your interest by
$60,000. Yep.
Okay. Now, if you look at scenario B, instead of putting money into the mortgage, you put it into an investment portfolio of some kind. Now, an investment portfolio at UGC, we're earning 13 to 15% per annum.
18.
Well, that's good. But I'm a financial planner, so let's be conservative. Let's say you're earning 10%.
Last 3 years, 18.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what
I'm
I just
sorry,
said,
Joel,
properties
that?
Have averaged 7. So.
Last
without
years,
leverage.
18%. Yeah. Yep. 18%. Is that what you said?
Roughly 18%.
18%.
Yeah, on average.
I'm just going to say it again.
After fees.
18% after fees.
Watch the phones light up.
There you go. That's the point, Steph. Anyway, let's say 10% return. Now, 10% return would give you $381,000 at the end of 15 years instead of the $240,000 of putting it into the home loan. But there's a tax impact that we need to be aware of, because if you put it into the home loan, then you're reducing interest at 4% after tax. If you put it into an investment portfolio, then you're probably paying tax
okay.
on that 10% earnings.
Right. Mm.
Now, in reality, the tax is deferred because a lot of it is capital gains, mm-hmm. but I'm going to ignore that because I'm a conservative financial planner. Let's say it's just straight amount of tax at 39% for someone earning more than $90,000 a year. So that would mean the rate of return is reduced. You get $281,000 by putting it into an investment portfolio that you pay tax on versus $240,000 of the home loan.
Mm-hmm.
So would you rather have $281,000 or $240,000?
Oh, 81.
There you go.
Exactly.
So $180,000 is your own money. So from $180,000, you get an extra $101,000 from an investment portfolio versus only $60,000 in interest savings by putting it in your home loan.
Yep. When you can simplify it down to that level, it's an easy decision.
It is.
But most people just wouldn't even think about it that way.
That's right.
Everyone I know is like, you know, trying to pay the mortgage down still. And it is a mentality. You're talking about that. Yes, your parents did that. They paid it off.
That's right.
Yep.
You know, we're still thinking like that. So it's sort of changing the mindset.
It's well, it's a mindset. The majority issue. Are. I'm not convinced everyone is these days.
I'd say
the majority that we speak to have probably thought about it, but never had the courage of their conviction to go and pursue that strategy.
Well, here's the other thing. There's a lot more unknowns that you need to learn about when you get into an investment portfolio.
True.
But don't let that put you off, because there is money on the table for you. And if you are going to be more successful with your finances, which is why you're listening to this podcast, you need to look at things that are
out of the box,
outside your current level of knowledge, understanding, and comfort.
Mm-hmm.
All you need to do is become more educated, do the learning so that you are comfortable, because there are people doing this right now that are no different to you, except they've got new knowledges that you don't currently have.
Mm. Yep.
It's the only difference. Now, I'm going to take it a step further, because a lot of the benefit of that comparison is reduced because of the tax impact. So here's my hypothetical situation.
Mm.
If you've got that $1,000 per month, you've got the choice of, let's reduce my home loan by $1,000, or let's put it into an investment portfolio. what you can do is you can structure your debts in a more tax-effective way, where you can kind of do both. And that is, instead of getting $1,000 worth of investment with each contribution, you do a bit of pay one and then do the other as well. And here's how that works. You take your $1,000, you pay it off your home loan, you borrow $1,000 from a different loan account, and you use that $1,000 to get your investment.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, instead of, you don't just take your $1,000 and buy an investment, you take your $1,000, you still get your $1,000 investment, but you've reduced your home loan, which is not tax deductible, and you've taken up an investment loan, which is tax deductible.
Yep.
And now we have a tax comparable situation. Now you've got the earnings of an investment portfolio at 10% before tax versus the interest you pay on an investment loan, which is 4% before tax, or 6.1% earnings after tax versus 2.4% interest payments after tax. Let's do this over 15 years. Over 15 years, the interest you've paid in your investment loans after tax is $214,000. The earnings you've earned on your investment portfolio after tax is the $281,000. So how much have you made in profit? Someone help me with maths. 281 minus the 214 is...
66.
There you go. So you've just made that money from borrowing your investment capital and putting it into an investment where you earn a higher before tax or after tax return than what you're paying in debt.
Mm. So you've essentially converted what would have been a $40,000 differential into now a $66,000 differential.
Yep.
Which is more than 50% more than what you would have ended up under the original scenario.
Yeah.
Mm.
And all it is just a little bit of an openness to changing the way that you use your cash flows.
Mm. Yep. Yep. So this is the power of knowledge.
Yeah.
We're using a bit of knowledge to create money that didn't exist before.
Mm. And substantial. That's, very powerful.
That's
very
what
powerful
we do in indeed. Designing financial strategies.
Clever.
Very good advice. When do I book in?
Immediately, Steve.
Yeah, well, she won't take my advice.
This happens now.
At least she'll listen to somebody.
I'm not sure she will. Will she?
I'll listen.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You got to take the new knowledge. You got to be open to it and take it on. And then at some point, you got to hit the go button.
Yeah, that's true.
Because make unless you take the final action, there's nothing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, on that note, I'm going to throw over to Brett. How do we get in contact with UGC if we wanted to put a question up to the podcast?
Well, you can get in touch with UGC via their website at ugc.net.au. For our podcast at the Investor Exchange, you can ask us a question via our website at theinvestorexchange.com.au. You'll see a tab there. Click the Ask button and either type or record your message.
Good
Beautiful.
One. All right, and throwing over to our final segment of the day, your favourite, You Can't Be Serious. Now, who's going to start today? You all love this one.
Yeah, all right.
Don't have to twist your arm.
Well, this one's for our criminal listeners out there. Something to be mindful of.
Not exactly a smooth criminal, this one.
Not a smooth
criminal. I got a peek look at this one.
So, if you're on the run and the police are chasing you, one thing you need to be mindful of is the noises you might make that could give away your hiding spot. Case in point, it was in Missouri. And a particular criminal had the police on his track, and he gave himself away by a loud fart.
Obviously very scared.
Yes. So kudos to the police for sniffing him out.
Oh, come on.
That's sometimes how I find my daughter when we're playing hide and seek.
We won't just play this back for her 18th birthday either. She's going to hate you. Anyone else free more?
Yeah, sure. I've got. I'm going to continue the theme of corporate fails for a little bit longer. So Chrysler Autos, the big auto manufacturer in Detroit, has a Twitter feed. And somebody on the Chrysler Autos Twitter feed thought that it would be worthwhile commenting on the abilities of the drivers in Detroit. I find it ironic that Detroit is known as the Motor City, yet no one here knows how to fucking drive.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Now, what about Adidas? Adidas had a big promotion around the Boston Marathon. Now, we all know the tragic events that took place in 2013.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where there was the unfortunate bombings at the Boston Marathon. Well, you'd think someone at Adidas would be a little bit smarter about their congratulatory
messaging
at the end of the 2017 Boston Marathon. So Adidas Running, their Twitter feed, came out with, "Congrats, you survived the Boston Marathon."
Oh, jeez.
Oh, I bet that one bombed.
I was waiting for that word to be in there.
Any more free more Louis?
Yes, I do. Yeah, that. Thanks, Brett. I deserve that. Yeah. I do have one. Lots of people aspire to have a fancy car, one of these supercars. A particular physicist in the UK really wants a Lamborghini Aventador. But no ways he could afford the £275,000 price tag. Mm. So he and his son decided to 3D print one.
Wow.
3D print a Lamborghini Aventador. Okay.
So there you go. They spent about $20,000 on 3D printers and printing materials to make the outside of the car. And then various assortments of car parts. So it's an actual car that's going to drive. So they've got a steering column, a chassis, windows.
All good things for a car to have.
Yeah, that's right. And it's going to be powered by a 2003 Chevy V8 engine with two turbochargers. So there you go.
Incredible.
So it's going to be a pretty decent car by the end of it.
Do you have copyright issues over doing something like that, I wonder?
Good question.
Yeah. Good question.
Because it will look like a Lamborghini.
It will look like a Lamborghini, and that's their intention.
Yeah.
I kind of think that was kind of like smart investing, Louis. I mean, they've saved a lot of money. And
they've saved a lot of money. That's right. That's right. Mm. Into an asset that's going to depreciate.
Yes.
That's a shame.
Yeah. If you don't drive it, maybe it goes up over time. Who knows?
Yeah. Collectible car. Yeah, very unique. Scarcity.
One of a kind. Yep. Who knows? Mm. Who knows?
Well, interesting topics. But thanks again for our listeners for tuning in, and thanks for everyone in the studio, and we'll see you all again next week.
Thanks, Steph.
Thanks, Steph.
Thanks,
listeners.
Bye.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalized, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.